cliffcentral.com.
It's like the longest introduction to a song I've ever heard in my life. It's meant to be Slave to Love by Brian Ferry, but it seems like it's a 15-minute intro, and then they'll eventually get to the song. So I'm just going to can it. We don't need that in our lives, do we? Some pain is just too much to bear. All right, it is cliffcentral.com on a Thursday morning. It's everybody's favorite day. Why? Because we get to do the burning platform. And this morning we are joined by Canthan Pillay, who's our return champion, and Ivo Fechter. Ivo Fechter is someone who we've had on the show many times, and Ivo is writing for the Daily Friend at the moment. He's also written some really, really interesting stuff recently. But I see, Ivo, that you also picked up on an article that I saw yesterday in the Daily Maverick, your old stomping ground, where I've apparently there's a shrine to me somewhere. I'm unaware of this.
Oh, there is, absolutely. Good morning, Gareth.
Morning.
No. Every evening at sunset, I orient myself towards your studio and bow down. And
what is this bullshit?
Give praise to our Lord and Master.
Yeah. So where did this article come from? Who's the guy who wrote this?
It's Ismail Lagadin who wrote this. And he seems to be very sore about the fact that the libertarians and you being the sort of, what did he call you? He called you the Rush Limbaugh of South African radio. That we're winning, that we're getting the lockdown lifted and so on, that we're placing profits before people and, the economy before lives.
Wow.
So okay. It's the old argument where he basically misses out the fact that the economy is lives, that, we need to both fight COVID and save the economy.
You see, the left are so into the world of systematic and institutional and governmental that they've forgotten individuals exist, and they've forgotten that those individuals need to exist, and they need to sustain themselves by food and by income and by providing for their families and those they care about. It's much easier to just look at people theoretically, which is what so many people on the far left do. So this morning's Burning Platform, as ever, is brought to you by Nando's. Canthan, how are you feeling this morning?
Well, I don't have a shrine to myself. What have I done?
You're feeling a bit sorry for yourself, I see.
I'm feeling sorry for myself, yeah.
All right, guys, let's get stuck into something really important. Tito Mboweni made a speech yesterday, and he was very direct.
Did he?
Yes, it's kind of in the news, Ivo. this is why we get you on. He had quite a lot to say about the state of our economy post-coronavirus. It was tabled to some kind of emergency budget discussion. He's already come under fire from the opposition. But I thought perhaps you guys could give us your thoughts front and center about what you might have liked or disliked about what Tito Mboweni had to say.
Well, I've got an opening gambit, which I'm going to toss in.
Okay.
And one thing that I definitely agree with Tito Mboweni on, and it was a compelling image, we need to close the mouth of the hippopotamus.
That was his metaphor for corruption, right?
Yes, absolutely. No, closing the mouth of the hippopotamus, I take the view that the hippopotamus is actually government, which is swallowing up everything, and we need to close its mouth.
All right. That's
so in as much as he referred to corruption, yes, I'm taking the view government is the hippopotamus,
okay,
and we need to close its mouth.
All right. He spoke very much about the fact that there just isn't any more money. The hippopotamus can't keep its mouth open because there's nothing left to feed it. There isn't space for corruption anymore. We've spent everything we have, and we now need to build infrastructure with money that we don't have. We need to care for an increasingly unbelievably large welfare state, which we've also created. And with the state of the economy, the parlous state that it's in, businesses closing, tax revenues at an all-time low. I saw Edward Kiesvetter was on the news last night talking about how he has to try to put plasters and band-aids over all the holes in what would have been his revenue, and therefore government's revenue for the year.
I think, look, Mboweni didn't mince his words about the depth of the trouble that we're in. And I think that's very good. I think a lot of people, most of us know this, but I think a lot of people in his own party and in the tripartite alliance need to hear this, right? They need to know, they need to have this wake-up call that we are really in very, very deep trouble. And there's a lot of things, factions and special interests and so on, that are preventing him from even trying to balance the budget. You know, so he said, you know, our projected budget deficit will more than double to 15%, 15.7% of GDP from the 6.8% that was expected in February. I mean, that's a massive, massive change. Gross national debt skyrocketing to 81.8% of GDP,
right,
up from the projection in February of 65%. I mean, that's a 25% increase in our projected national debt, you know, by the end of this year. I mean, that is absolutely massive.
But,
and I like
Ivo, one of the things that, you know, I need to climb in on, people don't relate well to percentages, but consider that our budget deficit for this year is effectively going from billion rand a day to 2 billion rand a day. I think people can actually relate to that figure.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's true.
That's stark. I mean, frightening.
Well, you just look at the absolute numbers. 761.7 billion rand, right? So 760 odd billion rand. Now, the total budget is in the region of just over 2 trillion rand. Right? So that gives you an idea. I mean, 35% of our budget is unfunded. You know, that's absolutely massive. Now, I like the idea that he raised the specter of the Weimar Republic and Zimbabwe and Argentina, you know, and another country hit by sovereign debt crisis. He used the word bankruptcy, and he really needs to do that. I think people need to scare some sense into the ANC and its union allies. But beyond telling us how much trouble we're in, right, it was a big fat nothing burger. He said nothing. You know, you'd think with this kind of crisis, well, what do? Well, we either raise revenues or we tighten our belts, we reduce expenditure, or both.
Yeah.
He didn't either. Yeah. So.
But you do have people who are still calling for him to print money, and otherwise quite sensible people. Now, what do you gentlemen think of that? Because it is something that's being trotted out by a number of commentators. Oh, well, if we just print money and ease the quantitative easing, then everything will be all right because government can just make money out of thin air.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it? There is a money tree after all.
Desperation is the tender trap, you two said about 20-something years ago.
Yeah.
Well, either of you explain why that would be a bad idea so we can, for once and for all, put away arguments that are trotting that out as some kind of intellectual opposition to dealing with the crisis in a sensible and adult way?
Well, I'll give you the executive summary, okay? Yeah. And firstly, consider that I have a fundamental opposition to the idea of printing money. But let's just say that we're dealing in a world where people frequently resort to printing money.
Okay.
And printing money can be used in a short term in order to plug certain holes. But the flip side of that is that in order for it to be successful, there has to be growth that emerges from that process in order to be able to then pay back the money that has been effectively printed. So you can have a short term burst in terms of increasing the money supply in order to boost spending, which is meant to trigger economic growth. But we don't have growth in the horizon in the long term. And the only way right now that one can actually spur any type of growth is by effectively borrowing to supplement that. And effectively, we're going to be in a scenario where, consider right now, 21 cents out of every rand is going towards paying for debt. But then a further 38 cents of every rand is going to pay for the public service bill. So, you know, printing money, what are we going to do with that money? We're going to spend it on paying more public servants. And that leads us down Zimbabwe. That leads us down all of those examples, because that's exactly what happened to them.
Maybe explain it as if it were you doing your household budget.
Look, the thing with printing money is that in a large economy, the economy can actually absorb that kind of impact, you know, that kind of increase in the money supply. Now, what happens to that money? A lot of people say, and you know, a lot of libertarians like to say, well, it causes inflation. It's not quite that simple, because it often doesn't cause or it appears not to cause much consumer price inflation, which is what most people think of when they think of inflation.
Yes.
What it does do, however, is it causes asset price inflation, because if you think of how this money enters the economy, right, the central bank buys up bonds, government bonds. In the States, they're now buying corporate bonds. So it buys up debt, and that money goes into the banking system, right? So it basically goes into the top of the economic system. From there, it goes to the bank's wealthy clients, the guys that can afford loans, right? Mm-hmm. So these are corporate loans or large personal loans. Where does that money go? Well, either the corporates sit on it, right, as a rainy day buffer,
yeah,
or it gets invested into assets. Right, these could be properties, houses. These could be stock markets, equities, and that's where the money goes. So, what you see when you see all these stock market booms, right? The stock market at the moment is flying. Right, international stock markets are flying. Why? When the world is in such crisis, well, simply because they're printing so much money, and this goes straight into the stock market.
So it doesn't help. It doesn't help poor people at all. Then, is what you're saying?
No, what you're doing is you're redistributing money from the poor to the rich. Right, then the stock market does well, and you say, point to the stock market and say, look, the economy is doing well. No, but the stock market isn't the economy.
Right.
You know, the economy is what you and I earn. The economy is what small businesses earn. Right, it's what how many people get employed by small businesses. That's the economy. Right, the stock prices are not the economy. That's almost a casino that rich people play with. So the idea of printing money is really, really short-sighted. And it doesn't really help many people except for the rich and except for big business, perhaps. So there are a lot of issues with printing money that just make it a really bad idea. In a small economy, of course, we don't have that kind of flexibility in the economy. So we're going to end up with consumer price inflation much, much faster than Europe or the US would.
I think we're already seeing that uptick in prices, Ivo.
Yeah, well, at the moment, inflation is apparently at 3%. If you buy the CPI figures, which I never really have. So inflation is low because demand is low, right? And that's, that's sort of a countervailing force. But that's going to change. And as soon as demand picks up, you're going to see inflation, yes.
What do you think Cyril thinks of all of this? Because we hear Tito, and often Tito's in stark contrast to what a lot of other voices in the ANC are saying. And he had some things to say, talk about the hippopotamus, but he's basically talking to people in his own party and saying, guys, the buffet, the gravy train is over. But we know that's unpopular in the ANC. Do we know what the president thinks, or is he going to continue to be this conciliatory.
The president doesn't give a shit, because if he did, then we would not have had the loss of revenue from tobacco. We would have not have had loss of revenue from alcohol.
Right.
Both of which his finance minister warned him about and said the impact of this on our revenue collection is going to be astronomical. And the president ignored him and went ahead anyway. So that pretty much tells you what's going on. I think the ANC is in a scenario right now where a lot of them would desperately like to get rid of Tito, but yeah, they're also aware of the ripple effect of having another Des Van Rooyen impacting on the markets. And so for that reason, I think Tito is going to be there for the short term, you know, probably up until around about early next year. And then I suspect that he's going to be eased out.
But, you know, remember that Tito is also a socialist. You know, he might be aware of how to budget and the issues around debt and around the balanced budget that he has expressed. But he's ultimately a socialist, which means he will support socialist plans. And you see that in job creation, for example. Now, they throw 100 billion rand at job creation. Most of which goes into government job creation, so civil service job creation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, that's just not productive. You know, it's exactly the opposite of what's needed. I mean, private sector employees boost the economy. They produce more value than they earn. Right? Public sector employees don't. right? What do we need more public sector employees for? What are they going to do? What are they going to produce? How are they going to contribute to the economy? They're going to be a deadweight cost to the economy, paid for by taxpayers.
Huh? And yes, this is but they become a captive voting block. I will.
That's exactly that. Right. And I was going to say, for that reason, that they're almost in sheltered employment until the ANC needs them, which is once every 4 years. And in between, when they need a coterie of people around them who will approve of and consent to their various machinations.
Yes, I think that's an important point. You know, Franz Grenier, the head of the IRR, he's just published a book in which he says that the ANC is swiftly losing electoral support. And especially now with the COVID crisis, with the lockdown crisis, he might actually be faced with losing an election in 2024. Now, if the ANC does lose an election, of course, there's a lot of consequences for that. They'll probably go into alliance with the EFF, which means we'll swing far more to the left. It's a nightmare scenario, whichever way you look at it, you know, whether or not they lose that election. But yeah, to support the voting numbers, well, if you're going to employ another, I don't know, 500,000 or so civil servants, that would be great for the ANC voting numbers, because you can be sure that the people who gave them those jobs, very well paid jobs at that, are going to be supporting the ANC.
Do you think, Canton, that ultimately there's going to be any cutting to the public wage bill? Because we've heard this come from Tito before. He said this is important. He said he's going to do it, but we haven't seen it happen, have we?
Well, I've been looking through some of the numbers. You know, there's the 109-page full budget review, which I still haven't completed going through. And, you know, I've just been taking a look at it. So essentially what he's looking at is something like 145 billion increase in budget at many levels. And then there's a 100 billion decrease at a number of levels. So what he talks about, for example, there's national departments baseline suspensions. So that's about 54 billion comes from there.
Yep.
Repurposing of provincial equitable share, which sounds like smoke and mirrors to me, but there's another 20 billion out there.
Right.
Local government conditional grant suspensions, about another 12 billion. So yeah, ultimately he's put in about 100 billion in terms of non-interest expenditure that gets revised downwards, and about 145 billion in expenditure directly resulted to COVID that gets revised upwards, which, considering that nearly all of that comes from the fact that we've increased our deficit, we've doubled our budget deficit, none of it looks real to me at this point in terms of the numbers. So on that level, yes, he's been promising to do lots in terms of cutting back, but I'm not seeing it in the numbers so far. But I still have about 100 pages to go in terms of this.
Lucky you. What wonderful reading. That people are so jealous of your life, Canton. At the moment, I'm getting emails from people saying, wow, Canton really does have the most exciting time reading those kinds of things.
Well, if I don't get that sort of information myself, then I'm going to have to rely upon woke idiots on Twitter for information.
Fair enough.
You see, if I don't read documents like that, I'm going to have to resort to sleeping pills.
but Ivo, you make your way through these things, but they're just mind-numbingly boring, and a lot of it, the devil's in the detail, right? So you have to actually read it yourself so you can find out what's really going on, as opposed to what they want you to hear, those headlines.
No, absolutely.
Do you agree, though, that, for example, you wrote recently, there are numerous excellent reasons to be skeptical of sin taxes. And you spoke about this. This is something which keeps coming up. And every year we laugh because whichever finance minister it is, you know, even the non-funny ones like Pravin Gordhan, they talk about the sin taxes and they get a laugh from people. But in effect, these sin taxes have been built up and built up and built up. And during the lockdown is probably the first time that we felt the impact of not having them in the fiscus. And it's substantial. There's a lot of money that's been squandered that could have been made, that's gone into the underworld and into the black market. But you think that sin taxes aren't even effective and we shouldn't bother with them?
Well, you know, they actually contradict themselves. If you read the sort of SARS justification for sin taxes, right, their primary justification is to raise revenues.
Yes.
Right? So it's got nothing to do with the health of smokers or drinkers or whatever.
Yeah.
Its secondary justification is discouraging consumption of harmful products. But if they discourage consumption of those harmful products, then they're going to raise less revenue, which is their primary justification for sin taxes. So they're contradicting themselves in the very motive for sin taxes. They don't produce as much to the budget as one thinks, actually. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it really isn't nearly as much as you think. So whether they really make that big a difference to the budget, you know, I'm skeptical of that.
Well, the numbers that Kiesewetter told us in terms of April, let's use that as an example. He said that we had a 400 million rand loss in terms of the taxes on cigarettes. We had a 400 million rand loss in terms of the taxes on spirits, and a 600 million loss in terms of the taxes on beer.
So that's
about 1.4 billion for the month, yeah, roughly.
1.4 billion. Have you seen the budget deficit?
Yes.
761.7 billion.
Yeah, and no arguments whatsoever.
So we're talking about a fraction of a percent here.
Yes, very much so. So you're effectively talking about the amount of money that those taxes raise in a month gets spent by government in about half a day.
Jesus, yeah, that's extraordinary.
Exactly, a couple of hours. Go out for lunch and that money is gone.
Yeah, put that way, it's really quite a frightening prospect. So gentlemen.
Now consider that all these sin taxes, they're a deadweight cost to the economy, right? They negatively affect the numbers of jobs and the incomes of workers involved in the value chains of all these tax products.
Right.
They incentivize people to seek out cheaper, lower quality alternatives, right? Or to turn to the black market for their fix, whether it's booze or cigarettes. If you delve into it, it actually even reduces the supply of other products in the market,
mm-hmm.
in various complicated ways, you know, because people have to pay their sin taxes somehow, which means I'm not spending that money on something that could be making someone else good income. I could be doing all sorts of things with the money that I'm spending on sin taxes right now. So there's all sorts of economic consequences. And the question really is whether those economic consequences are a price worth paying for the very small amount of revenue that sin taxes really produce and the very dubious effectiveness of sin taxes. Because they, especially they do reduce demand among moderate smokers or drinkers. But for heavy smokers or drinkers, apparently they make very little difference. Those people are addicted. They will pay whatever they need to. And you've actually seen this now with the lockdown when, cigarettes went to, I think the highest I've paid is 180 rand a packet on the black market. And people pay that because they want their fix.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubting that. I mean, Kosa Sana Dlamini Zuma, for all of her trouble, has tried to reduce the number of people who smoke in the country. And for whatever reason, she's got this bugbear about smoking. But she's also just recently said that she's going to challenge that finding by the High Court that has declared these lockdown regulations unconstitutional and arbitrary. And she's going to challenge it. And she says she doesn't understand where they came up with this ruling, because to her mind, she's well within her rights to make these rules. And they're obviously taking it all the way to the top.
Yes, but why would you willingly relinquish power when you have the opportunity to actually strike down a potential threat to it? So the norm for government is going to be to always continue appealing and continuing to delay while they continue to do exactly what they do, because there are no consequences that accrue to government as a direct result of this.
And nobody ends up with personal costs. Well, very rarely do they end up with personal costs to that effect either. So they can keep challenging these things and letting the public pay for them, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you know, I mean, the entire concept of personal costs, you know, which, and we discussed that on this show before, Gareth, where we were looking at the public protector who had been struck with personal costs. And I said that, well, you know, it's actually a bad idea at that level. You know, really what we need to do is to not have idiots in government to start off with. And, and I think that that's really where the focus should be rather than trying to punish people. Remember that what's going to happen is that you have a scenario where you have personal costs of, you know, a couple of hundred thousand that accrue against a particular individual. Meanwhile, the corruption that has resulted from that individual's actions has literally poured billions into pockets of that person's inner circle. You know, so the money is much of a muchness.
But can
and they'll happily stump up the costs, yeah.
Can I ask both of you to help me solve a perpetual problem in South Africa? And I don't know whether we'll get even close to halfway to solving this problem, but we've got a major public transport issue in South Africa, and we had taxi strikes this week. The taxi business has got government by the throat, and very often government have acceded to all their demands. And slowly it's becoming less and less possible for them to just dish out money to the taxi industry. But we have no long-term solutions in the pipeline to supplement, for those people who don't have an option, possible ways for them to get to and from work, to and from the doctor, to and from school for their children. We surely have to have some better way of helping the people of South Africa get around than what we've got at the moment. And all of us being held ransom by the taxi associations when they decide to strike and block off roads and make it impossible for all of us to travel. Do you have any thoughts on that, Canton?
Yeah, I have. Look, I know I was always been a fan of taxis for years because, you know, ultimately this was a free market response to a gap in the market. The problem that we have with the taxis right now is that the people who own the taxis are not the people who necessarily drive the taxis.
Yes.
And so if you look down the value chain, you will find that a lot of those ANC leaders who are currently sitting in parliament happen to own fleets of taxis themselves.
Right.
Now, consider that every single taxi driver has to first generate, let's say, 1,000 rand a day that goes back to the taxi owner, and everything after that they keep as their profit. So they drive like maniacs just to be able to pay their rent for the taxi for that particular day, and then they actually start earning their own salaries. But we can't just suddenly turn around and say, well, we're going to put in light rail rapid transit around the country at massive expenditure on the part of the people, because we don't have the money, we don't have the time, because the taxis actually keep the economy ticking over. I would fix the taxi industry by doing a very simple thing. I would introduce a medallion system like New York City used to have for its yellow cabs. So in other words, you have to own your vehicle in order to drive a minibus taxi. And the impact of that immediately is that it results in real empowerment on the ground, because that means that that person actually owns their means of production. The second thing that I would do thereafter is that I would actually subsidize taxis. But in exchange for subsidizing taxis, you would need to have a cashless payment system that would need to take place, because then that allows the state to then be able to track exactly where the movements of individuals come from. And then that ties in terms of long-term planning on how you actually build rapid transit. So, for example, if you're able to see the pattern based on tracking of where people are actually traveling, you know, smart card or phones or whatever we're using for that, we'd be able to actually say, well, this person is traveling on a daily basis from Mamelodi across to Orlando, as an example. And therefore, it actually makes sense to have a rail link that is addressing that particular gap, because there's enough volumes to actually justify it. But all of this actually requires, first and foremost, that you actually have to stop the taxi associations in their track. And the best way to do that right now for me, hand over ownership to the individuals. But in exchange for that, you are subsidizing them. They're going to end up earning a decent living. So it's a win-win scenario. But yeah, it's effectively, it's protection money in the long term. but it's the way in which we actually productively work our way out of this.
Get thee behind me, Satan.
Yeah, I knew you'd have a problem with this, so the floor is yours. Go ahead, Ivor.
All right. Oh, I hate what Kenton just said. Medallion system. This is just one of those systems where you create an artificial cartel, you create a monopoly. I mean, if you look at in New York, they pay $1 million or something for these medallions, and the yellow cabs in New York basically own the city. You know, this is why Uber can't get a look in, for example. It's an incredibly anti-competitive system. And it's very hard for new competition to arise.
Well, my question is, isn't that just another kind of taxi association?
It is. It's exactly the opposite.
I'm not suggesting for a second that you have a cap in terms of the number of medallions that get issued. I'm just saying that if you're driving a taxi, you have to own the taxi. So in other words, so that you don't have an ANC boss behind the scenes who has this fleet of taxis that is then feeding tax-free money back into that person's pockets.
But business works this way all the time. One guy brings capital, which is the taxi owner in this case. He can afford to buy the vehicles and so on and pay the taxi driver a nominal salary. And someone else works for them and does the actual job on the ground.
So we're all happy campers. So what's the problem? Let's just leave it as it is, shall we?
No, I would absolutely make changes. Look, cashless, and I've actually written a report for this on the IRR, cashless transactions is simply not going to work. And there's a lot of reasons why. But, you know, I'm not going to go into all the details. But demanding that there's cashless transactions, you know, I know the taxman would love it, but it's not going to work. The passengers don't like it, drivers don't like it, and owners don't like it either. Subsidies is an interesting one because trains and buses are subsidized, right? So I think the taxis actually have a legitimate claim to say, well, they also should be subsidized, right? To level the playing fields between them and other modes of public transport. But to me, the big thing that needs to change is the way that competition is being stifled. The government basically has co-opted the taxi associations in deciding who does and doesn't get a taxi license, right? So you need to be a member of an association. You need to drive on a specific route that the association prescribes in order to get your taxi license.
Yes.
Now, that is a problem because that restricts competition. I can't just buy myself a van and say, well, look, I'm going to drive people from here to there because I see there's a gap in the market. Right. I can't do that because in order to get my license, I must join a taxi organization. That taxi organization must then tell the government that I am approved to receive a license. Now, that's a problem. That's where government regulation basically formalizes the cartel system that the associations have, right? Which becomes a really problematic thing. That's why they can operate almost like a mafia. And they can keep other vehicles and other forms of transport off their routes. And we know when they don't do it through membership, they do it through violence. So the government needs to open up competition in the taxi sector. That would be a good thing. And I think that would make a huge difference.
Yeah, I don't know that we even have the wherewithal to commandeer a way out of this problem because the taxi associations have everybody by the throats. The commuters themselves don't have any other options. Free market options seem like a bit of a pipe dream, frankly, and anything to do with the state ultimately will run out of money because we've already financed, and I think they called it recapitalization, but all those taxis, those quantum taxis that we see, that's actually taxpayers' money that went into trying to make sure that at least the fleet of taxis that do transport people around are mostly not death traps. And I think even though many of us thought that it's a grudge purchase to do this for the taxi industry, many of us are relieved that at least that money was spent trying to put people in slightly safer vehicles. Do you have any final thoughts on that before we move on to the next thing?
Look, I just need to say that I broadly agree with Ivo in terms of, you know, in an ideal free market world, that's what one would do. The scenario that we have right now, we don't have that ideal free market world.
Right.
Solution that I'm proposing is to fix the problem. And even though it goes contrary to my free market principles, when you look at the way in which things are stuffed up right now, the solution is not going to come from just stepping back and letting the free market actually do its work. There has to be intervention to fix this problem because of the established cartels that actually prevent a free market from working effectively.
All right. Having said that, let's move on to some other things. Becky Taylor, who is usually in the news for all the wrong reasons. KZN authorities say that they want him to assist in stopping taxi and political violence in the province. Apparently, a taxi driver there was shot dead while probably terrifying in his spare time. He was ferrying commuters on Tuesday in the Wartburg area. Three teachers are fighting for their lives in hospital after they were wounded. KZN Community Safety MEC Becky Ntuli has said that the taxi industry in the Wartburg area is of great concern. He says this is not the first incident in that area. All those people who are being killed are either working in or part of the leadership of the taxi industry. They want the national government to bring in intelligence services to address these problems. Surely we can find out who's behind it.
Well, we do know who's behind it. There was a real-life example that happened in the greater Ladysmith area. I think it's called the Enambiti municipality, mm-hmm. in that neck of the woods. And this was back when Becky Taylor was still commissioner of police. And he basically went in there and called in all of the warlords from the various sides and got them all in the same room together. And he says, listen, I know you guys are killing each other and this needs to stop, because if it doesn't stop, I'm going to come in with police guns and I'm going to kill all of you.
So that's what it takes. It takes
mice. Well, that's what it took. Yeah. So and it actually worked. And then at the point at which Taylor was removed, then everything went to hell in a handbasket again. And right now, the quickest way to get a death sentence is to be elected as a municipal councillor in the NMBT district in KZN.
Jesus, sounds like Somalia.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wow, I didn't realize things were that gangster in that part of the world.
Yeah, unfortunately, people who are sitting in lockdown right now don't travel to these rural communities and actually get a sense of what things are like on the ground.
Ivo, you've been writing some interesting things recently, and I saw you get into an argument over faith and the role of faith in people's lives and the role of a secular constitution. What's troubling you at the moment that isn't necessarily in the news?
We had a long discussion about it. It was really about the nature of atheism and whether atheism sort of imposes a value system on people in the same way that religions do.
Yeah.
And I argued, and you know, I tried to make the point that atheism is not just another religion. You know, various people disbelieve in gods or deities, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily share the same values.
Right.
For many of them, they profoundly disagree on various issues. You know.
Do you think people need to have a system of faith in order to be good people?
No, absolutely not. I think that it is absolutely possible to develop a system of morality independently from appealing to a supernatural deity. I always said that I don't need a little black book to tell me how to live a good life and to tell me to be good to other people. You know, I don't kill people. You know, I don't need Exodus 2 or 20 or whatever it was to tell me that.
But Ivo, just to be devil's advocate for a minute, if you'll pardon the pun there.
One believes in the devil, of course.
Yeah, isn't part of what we're seeing in America almost a reaction to so many people who don't have religion in their lives trying to find a new value system of wokeness? And, you know, you can take Black Lives Matter or the 1619 Project of the New York Times or this general idea of intersectionality. And you can, if you want to, look at it as almost a value system which has been substituted for many people's lack of religious faith. Is there an argument to be made for that, or do you think that's completely fallacious and made up?
No, I don't think so. You know, I mean, I've used the example before of environmentalism, which is has all the hallmarks of
religion.
You know, I mean, it has Gaia, which you worship. You know, end up in a hell of global warming if you don't do, you know, you don't take your sacraments in the form of organic food. You know, you've got original sin. You've got all of the features of a pretty Catholic religion. Sort of wrapped up in environmentalism. So a lot of people say that, you know, environmentalism has become a secular religion. It's true, but you see, the thing is, not all people who don't believe in religion necessarily cling to some substitute, you know, whether that is wokeness or whether that is environmentalism. So, you know, a lot of atheists, in fact, a lot of the early atheists a few centuries ago clung to something called humanism. Mm-hmm. They try to define moral values and the moral philosophy in terms of, you know, what is best for individual people. You know, and that's where I fall. You know, I like to define morals in terms of what is best for me and for other people. You know, if I treat you well, you're going to treat me well. Now, I know that the Bible also says that, you know, but that is just common sense. It's a humanist principle. I don't need a supernatural being to tell me that.
But human beings like a system of values to almost just borrow from when they need to get some guidance, and sometimes.
Well, you see that?
Yeah, but Gareth,
Listen, far be it. Hold on, guys. I mean, far be it for me to like defend religion. I'm not going to hop on that bandwagon. But I do think that there's something to be said for a lack of purpose and meaning for many people on. Both the far right and the far left of the political spectrum, and that maybe this is some sort of substitute for them, whether it's environmentalism or Gareth, if you take a look at Gareth,
I assume all of us are familiar with the law of diffusion of innovation.
Tell us about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not.
Okay, well, essentially the way in which, you know, innovation actually works, you have something like 2% of the populace of the species who are able to come up with ideas that are truly innovative. Now, if you think about it, 2% of the populace generating innovative ideas on a constant basis is something that's would actually be really great.
Sure.
Except the problem is most of those innovations that 2% comes up with never actually make it into the mainstream. And the reason why it doesn't make it into the mainstream is because you don't get to the point where there's an uptick in terms of people actually taking that up. And essentially what needs to happen in order for any idea to actually gain credence, that 2% has to basically persuade at least another 15% of the populace to buy into the idea. So they become the people who are the early adopters, who take it up, and then they effectively start proselytizing that particular cause.
Mm-hmm.
Those early adopters then persuade a second group of people, the early majority, to then actually do the same thing. So, you know, think back to the time when the iPhone first came out and there were a handful of us who were trotting around with iPhones and everyone else was still buying their trusty Nokias and Blackberries and they were very happy with them.
Right.
And then it took a critical mass of 15% of us getting to that point. The 15% then persuade another group to buy into the idea. And then at the point at which that group buys into the idea, it then becomes mainstream, and then the people who are left, who are, again, roughly 50% of the population at that point, have no choice but then to buy into what has happened up until that point. Now, use that as a metaphor for just about everything that humans do, that the majority of the populace are actually waiting for someone else to tell them what to do
right.
at any given stage. And then they buy into it. So it's the entire madness around why so many people suddenly became Ramaphosa's praise singers during the lockdown, just simply because there were enough of a critical mass of people who got them to buy into that narrative. And yes, we are sheep as a species. We have to actually recognize this. We want to be led. And really what's important for those of us who value rationality above all else is to try and get to the point where our rational ideas actually become mainstream. And that's difficult.
Hell of a difficult. All right, so we're not going to solve this
problem.
But it does seem to me that there's a religious fervor to a lot of the political movement that we see around the world, whether it's Trumpism or whether it's wokeism, or whether it's environmentalism. There's a religious fervor, and I can't help thinking that that's filling that God-shaped hole in so many people's lives.
Yeah, look, I think that's one of the core problems, and it's a problem that I have with just liberal politics as well. You know, I talk about individual freedom and free markets, individual liberty and free markets. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that it seems that a majority of people actually, as Panthan said, want to be led. You know, they want dictators. They want an authoritarian government to tell them what to do. They want a paternalistic government, a nanny state, to protect them from this, that, and the other. You know, COVID comes around, and what do? We want government to protect us, and what does government do? Shut down the economy, and we say thank you very much, dear government, for having protected us from COVID. And that's, I think, that's the universal sort of instinct here, which sometimes comes out in religion, sometimes comes out in electing authoritarian figures, you know, populist dictators, and sometimes shows up in movements like the woke movement and like the environmental movement.
Why are the EFF so quiet, apart from complaining every now and then that Cyril's killing people by coming out of lockdown too fast? Why are they so quiet? Is it anything to do with VBS?
Well, I understand that Malema is hosting a press conference with one of his Mbongis from the SABC.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is. And yes. he's invited Pauli van Wyk, which is quite surprising, seeing as I think he once swore that he would never speak to her again.
Yes, but he said that he had then been advised by there was a string of tweets that he put up that said that he had been advised that in order for the conference to have credibility, it would be best for him to have Pauli van Wyk.
No, indeed. Look, I think the reason why he's been so quiet is because he hasn't really needed to say anything. He doesn't want to take too much of the blame for the whole lockdown thing, because the ANC is going to take that blame. And he knows that if the ANC loses, you know, I don't know, 5 or 10% of its share in the election, then the EFF is right there to pick up the slack,
to pick it up,
and either go into alliance with the ANC or to perhaps re-merge with the ANC. So I think he's strategically, he thinks the EFF is exactly where he needs it to be right now.
Yep, agreed. Mm-hmm.
Who is going to benefit from what's been going on this year when elections roll around?
The EFF.
Only the EFF.
Sadly.
No one else.
No, I actually think that the EFF Plus is going to see an uptick. I think that they've been working quietly behind the scenes. I think that the ANC is going to take a bit of a pounding. I think the DA is certainly going to take a pounding as well.
Yeah, why? Yeah. Why?
No, but you see, the reason I say sadly is I don't see anything, any sort of coalition on the right. Well, on the right of the ANC, which is probably still pretty left-wing, but I don't see any sort of coalition on the right that will make significant inroads in terms of capitalizing on the fact that the ANC may actually drop below 50% in the next national elections.
Yeah, so really all people like Julius have to do then is bide their time, right?
Bide their time, and he will, and he supports, he has enough support to then ally with, you know, whoever he wants. And that'll probably be the ANC, which will bring them back over 50%, which will make them an effective coalition government. I don't see a significant coalition arising on the right to challenge the ANC, sadly.
Guys, we didn't hear anything last night from Tito about this, but I couldn't help thinking while he was speaking, how long is it going to be before he is forced to look at raising taxes, and how much can South Africa bear in terms of a raise in taxes?
He actually did mention that, but he said he would announce that in his I think
the
either
medium term
in
extent, yeah,
the medium either, term either medium, the medium term, the October budget or the next budget in February.
Okay.
And there are issues with raising taxes in the middle of a tax year, so you know, perhaps that's why he hasn't raised taxes. But he has said that he will raise taxes, so expect that.
How much can he take it up?
Well, I don't think very much. I mean, I think even before the lockdown and before the massive hit that the economy took, I think we're already getting to a point on the Laffer curve where if you increase taxes more, you would basically just reduce economic output and as a result actually get less in terms of nominal taxes.
Canton, that sound you made made me worried. What does that mean?
No, I tend to agree with what I was basically saying. I think that he is going to end up raising taxes at some point, just simply because there's going to be pressure from within his party to raise taxes. But the impact on the economy, we certainly already gone backwards in terms of tax revenue. Effectively, you increasing the number of employed people who are high wage earners in the public service, and that money then gets taxed and flows back into the government. So effectively, it's not new money that's being generated that's flowing back into the tax pool. Because if I hire a public servant at R1 million a year and then tax that person at 45%, ultimately that money, if the entire sum of money, is still coming back from a very small core of productive people, and that core of productive people is what is shrinking on an ongoing basis. Yeah. We've already seen the outflow of capital in critical sectors like mining, for example.
Yes,
you know where I've spoken about the fact that Anglo is pretty much disinvested from this country. If you look in terms of what they actually still own compared to what they own in the rest of the world, and I think that that scenario is going to continue. There's certainly not going to be further inflows of capital from outside the country. Despite
Cyril talking about it just yesterday.
Yeah, look, essentially what he's been saying is that, you know, we still have people who are coming into the bond market. Yes, but the amount of people that are coming into the bond market compared to the amount of capital that has already fled the bond market is really what he needs to be talking about. Yes, they are. The reason why money is still flowing into our bond market, let's be very clear about this, is that in many parts of the world, you actually have negative interest rate. And this is one of the few places where you do that delicate juggling act besides, well, the rand is going to tank by a further 10%, but at the same time, we're likely to get, you know, some interest on our investment out here. So, you know, maybe we'll end up with about 1% overall, but that's still better than getting nothing in other parts of the world.
Slim pickings.
No, that's true. I mean, the only reason we've got money coming into the bond market is because we're paying them a hell of a lot of money to do so. You know, our interest rates are incredibly high, and our yields on the bonds are very high compared to everywhere else in the world. So, yeah, you're going to get very investors with a great risk appetite, right, who want to make money. You're going to see them going into the bond market. You won't see prudent investors coming into the South African bond market. But, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it. I mean, they say, oh, yeah, we want all this foreign direct investment. We want all this investment in South African industry. But then as soon as the money arrives, they say, well, we're going to tax you. We're going to increase taxes on the wealthy. We're going to increase capital gains taxes. We're going to increase this or that taxes. You're going to pay these and those license fees. You're going to have to comply with BEE regulations.
Right.
You're going to have to hand over X percent of your company for free to the government or to, you know, a designated BE organization. So you put all those roadblocks in the way of investment, and an investor is going to look at that and say, well, you know, shit, I could go to Australia and I have none of that.
Yeah.
You know, so where am I going to go?
Well, what I'm relieved about is this morning you two didn't agree on everything. We had a quite heated debate about taxis, for example. So that's a relief, because a lot of people say, oh, no, Ivo's back. That means he and Canton are going to agree for an hour. But it turned out not to be the case. Ivo, it's always good to see you. It's always good to chat to you. Thank you for your insights this morning, Canton. Very good to see you, too. And even though you didn't have a fight.
I missed your show last night. How was that?
Oh, it went well. It was really cool. We had your friend Mighty Jamie on.
Uh-huh.
We had Unati Kwaza on, who was terrific. She and Jamie started shouting at each other at some point, which was really good.
Excellent. I've got to watch it later on today. Yeah,
yeah, we'll post the YouTube link. Thank you, Canton. We'll post the YouTube link later on today. But Ivo and Canton, thank you both very much for your time today. And that is The Burning Platform, which is brought to you every week by Nando's. You can find the podcast on cliffcentral.com and pass it around to your friends, anybody else who's interested in what's really going on in South Africa and breaking down some of these current affairs stories and getting to the real truth of the matter, as well as some interesting opinions on how to solve some of our big problems. Thank you, Canton. Thank you, Ivo. Thank you to you.
Cliffcentral.com.